Present, urgent drone of conversation. Here and there a famous face, Goebbels leaning back against the back of a chair, arms folded, brooding, alone. Göring, in powder blue, like a general in an Italian opera, holding court to an attentive circle. As Hartmann threaded his way between them, he was conscious of heads turning to follow his progress. His eyes met eager, curious expressions, hungry for news, and he realized that they must know nothing, that they were all just waiting, even the most powerful figures in the Reich. He followed the adjutant's white jacket through a second set of doors, permanently open, he noticed, and into another huge reception room. The atmosphere here was quieter. Diplomats in frock coats and striped trousers were whispering to one another. He recognized Kirchheim from the French desk of the Foreign Ministry. On the left was a closed door with a guard beside it. In an armchair nearby was SS Sturmbannführer Sauer. He jumped to his feet as soon as he noticed Hartmann. "What are you doing here?"
"I have a message for the Foreign Minister."
"He's in with the Führer and the French ambassador. What is it?"
"Kott says Chamberlain has written the Führer a letter. The British ambassador wants to deliver it in person as soon as possible." Sauer absorbed this, nodded.
"All right. Wait here." The adjutant said, "Shall I leave Herr Hartmann with you, Herr Sturmbannführer?"
"Yes, of course." The adjutant clicked his heels and moved away. Sauer tapped lightly on the door, opened it, and disappeared inside. Hartmann looked around the salon. Once again he found himself calculating. One guard here, plus those he had already seen. How many did that make? 6? But Oster surely hadn't anticipated such a congregation of senior party figures inside the Chancellery. What if they had all brought bodyguards of their own? Göring, as head of the Air Force, would certainly have several.
Sauer reappeared. "Tell Kort that the Führer will receive Ambassador Henderson at 12:30.
"Of course, Herr Sturmbannführer." As Hartmann set off back towards the lobby, he looked at his watch. It was just 11:30. What were Heinz and the others doing? If they didn't strike soon, half the Berlin diplomatic corps might be caught in the crossfire. He opened one of the doors to the lobby and left it ajar. The adjutant was nearby. Hartmann went over to him.
"I need to make an urgent call to the Foreign Ministry."
"Yes, Herr Hartmann."
He was like some handsome stallion. Now that he had been broken, he could not be friendlier. He led Hartmann over to the big desk facing the entrance and gestured to the telephone.
"You will be automatically connected to the operator."
"Thank you."
Hartmann waited until he'd moved away, then picked up the receiver. A male voice said, "Can I help you?"
Hartmann gave the number of Kord's direct line and waited for the connection. Through the open door of the entrance he could see the back of one of the SS guards, and beyond him a couple of limousines drawn up in the courtyard. Two chauffeurs in SS uniform were leaning against one of the cars, smoking. He guessed they must be armed. There was a click, half a ringtone, and the phone was answered.
"Kort?"
"Erich?"
"It's Paul. A message from the Chancellery. The Führer will see Henderson at 12:30.
"Understood. I'll inform the British Embassy."
Kort's voice was staccato.
"It's busy here. Much busier than I expected."
He hoped Kort would detect his warning emphasis.
"I understand. Just stay where you are. I'm coming over."
Kort rang off. Hartmann kept the receiver pressed to his ear and pretended he was still listening. The door to the salon remained slightly open. It occurred to him that when the attack began, his best tactic would probably be to shoot the adjutant to prevent him closing it. The thought of the blood seeping through that immaculate white jacket gave him a moment of pleasure. The operator said,
"Do you wish to make another call?"
"No, thank you." He replaced the receiver.
Suddenly he was aware of a commotion outside. A man was on the steps demanding loudly to be admitted.
The adjutant hurried towards the entrance, and Hartmann's hand slipped immediately beneath the fabric of his suit to his inside left pocket. He could feel the cold metal of his gun. There was an exchange on the steps, and then a stooped, bespectacled, red-faced figure in a bowler hat pushed his way into the lobby. He was out of breath and elderly. He looked as if he might be about to have a heart attack. Hartmann withdrew his hand at once. He recognized him from the diplomatic circuit. It was the Italian ambassador, Attolico. His eye fell on Hartmann. He squinted at him in dim recognition.
"You are from the Foreign Ministry, yes?"
His German accent was atrocious. "Yes, Your Excellency."
"Will you please tell this fellow I need to see the Führer at once?"
"Of course." To the adjutant, Hartmann said, "Leave this with me." He guided Otolico towards the Grand Salon. The adjutant made no attempt to stop him. Otolico nodded to a few of the men he recognized, to Goebbels and to Göring, but he did not break his step, even as the conversations paused all around them. They went on into the second reception room. Sauer scrambled to his feet in surprise. Hartmann said, "His Excellency needs to speak with the Führer." Otolico said,
"Tell him I have an urgent message from the Duce."
"Of course, Your Excellency." After Sauer had vanished into the other room, Otolico remained where he was, staring straight ahead. He was trembling slightly. Hartmann said, "Would you care to sit, Your Excellency?" Otolico briefly shook his head. There was the sound of a door opening. Hartmann turned to look. Sauer emerged first, followed by the Foreign Office interpreter, Paul Schmidt, and then, frowning, his arms crossed over his chest, plainly both mystified and wary of what this sudden arrival might portend, Adolf Hitler. Chapter 3. Leggett was in the garden room of number 10, once again standing behind Joan as she finished typing the Prime Minister's speech. It was just after 1 o'clock. The PM was due to leave for the House of Commons at 2. Unlike his broadcast of the night before, this one was a monster, as long as a budget statement. 42 typed pages, more than 8,000 words. No wonder it had taken until the early hours of the morning to complete. Leggett reckoned the old man would need the best part of an hour and a half simply to deliver it, even if there were no interruptions.
"Today, we are faced with a situation which has had no parallel since 1914.
It was so long, not by choice, but of necessity. Parliament had been in recess for the past 2 months, and when the House had risen for the summer, there had been no Czech crisis, no imminent war, no gas masks or slit trenches. Families had gone on holiday. England had beaten Australia in the fifth test at the Oval by an innings and 579 runs. It had been another world. The Prime Minister had a duty to bring the country's elected representatives up to date on all that happened since July. The telegrams and minutes on which the speech was based, which Leggett had compiled for the PM the night before, were at that moment being printed by His Majesty's Stationery Office as a white paper. The Czechoslovakian crisis, notes of informal meetings of ministers. It would be released to peers and MPs at the same time as the Prime Minister was speaking. Not every document was to be made public. The Foreign Office and the Cabinet Office had weeded out the more sensitive documents. In particular, the agreement between Chamberlain and the French Prime Minister Daladier, that even if a war was fought and won, Czechoslovakia in its present form would cease to exist, was to remain classified. As Sires observed, it would be bloody hard to convince people the sacrifice was worth making if that became known. Joan finished typing the final page and pulled it from her machine. 4 copies. 1 top sheet for the Prime Minister, plus 3 flimsy carbons, for the Foreign Office, the Cabinet Office, and for number 10. She clipped each of them together and handed them to Leggett.
"Thank you, Joan."
"You're welcome." He lingered for a moment beside her desk.
"Joan what, might I ask?"
"Just plain Joan will be sufficient, thank you." He smiled and went upstairs to his office. To his surprise, he found the room was occupied. Cleaverly was seated at his desk. He couldn't swear to it, but it seemed to him that the older man had been going through his drawers.
"Ah, Leggett, I was looking for you. Is the PM's speech ready?"
"Yes, sir. It's just been typed up." He showed him the copies.
"In that case, there's something else I need you to do, if you wouldn't mind coming with me."
Leggett followed him along the corridor into the principal private secretary's office. He wondered what was coming next. Cleverly pointed to his desk, where the telephone receiver lay on the blotter beside its cradle.
"We're keeping the line open to the embassy in Berlin. We can't risk losing the connection. I want you to listen out for news at the other end. All right?"
"Of course, sir. What exactly is it I'm listening out for?
Hitler has agreed to give Sir Neville Henderson an audience. He should be back from the Chancellery at any minute, with Hitler's response to the Prime Minister's letter.
Leggett drew in his breath. My goodness, things are getting tight.
They most certainly are. I'll be with the PM, added Cleaverley. The moment you hear anything, let us know.
Yes, sir. Cleaverley's office, like Wilson's, had a communicating door with a cabinet room. He stepped through it and closed it after him. Leggett sat at the desk. He picked up the receiver and placed it cautiously to his ear. When he was a boy, his father had given him a shell and told him that if he listened hard enough, he would be able to hear the sound of the sea. That was what he heard now. How much of it was the hiss of static on the line, and how much the sound of his own blood pulsing through his ear, it was impossible to tell. He cleared his throat.
"Hello? Is anyone there?"
He repeated it a couple of times.
"Hello? Hello?"
It was a task that could have been entrusted to a junior clerk. Presumably that was the point. It was designed to put him in his place. He glanced out of the window at the deserted garden. A blackbird was hopping around the PM's bird table, pecking at the crumbs. He wedged the heavy Bakelite receiver between his ear and his shoulder, took out his pocket watch, disconnected it from its chain, and placed it open on the desk. He started to go through the Prime Minister's speech, checking it for errors. "For His Majesty's Government, there were three alternative courses that we might have adopted. Either we could have threatened to go to war with Germany if she attacked Czechoslovakia, or we could have stood aside and allowed matters to take their course. Or, finally, we could attempt to find a peaceful settlement by way of mediation." After a while, Leggett laid aside the speech and brought the watch up close to his face. The little hand was an elongated diamond shape, the big hand much finer. If one looked closely at it, one could just about see its infinitesimal movement as it worked its way towards the vertical. He imagined the German soldiers in these last few minutes waiting in their barracks for the signal to move out, the troop trains heading towards the Czech border, the panzers trundling down the narrow country roads of Saxony and Bavaria. At 1:42 p.m., a male voice said, "Hello, London?" Leggett's heart jumped.
"Hello, this is London. This is the embassy in Berlin. Just checking the line is still open."
"Yes, it seems to be fine, our end. What's happening over there?"
"We're still waiting for the ambassador to return from the Chancellery. Stand by, please."
The hiss resumed. The blackbird had disappeared. The garden was deserted. It was starting to spot with the rain. Leggett went back to the speech. "In those circumstances, I decided that the time had come to put into operation a plan which I had had in my mind for a considerable period as a last resort." As Big Ben struck 2 o'clock, the door opened and the top half of Cleaverley's body appeared.
"Anything?"
"No, sir."
"The line is still working?"
"I believe so."
"We'll give it another 5 minutes, then the PM will have to go."
The door closed. At 2:07, Leggett heard the sound of the telephone being picked up in Berlin. A nasal voice said,
"This is Sir Neville Henderson."
"Yes, sir. This is the Prime Minister's private secretary." Leggett reached for his pen.
"Please tell the Prime Minister that Herr Hitler has received a message from Signor Mussolini, delivered by the Italian ambassador, assuring him that in the event of conflict, Italy will stand by Germany, but asking him to postpone mobilization for 24 hours so that the situation can be re-examined. Please tell the Prime Minister that Herr Hitler has agreed. Have you got all that?"
"Yes, sir. I'll tell him now." Leggett hung up. He finished writing and opened the door to the cabinet room. The Prime Minister was sitting next to Wilson. Cleaverley was opposite him. As his head swung to face Leggett, the tendons on his thin neck stood out. He looked like a man about to be hanged, standing on the trapdoor, but still hopeful of a reprieve.
"Well?"
"Mussolini has sent a message to Hitler. Italy will fulfill its obligations to Germany if it comes to war, but he has asked Hitler to postpone mobilization for 24 hours, and Hitler has agreed."
"24 hours?"
Chamberlain's head drooped in disappointment. "Is that all?" Wilson said, "It's better than nothing, Prime Minister. It shows he's having to listen to outside opinion, at least. This is good news."
"Is it?
I feel as though I'm slithering towards a cliff edge and trying to catch hold of every root and branch to stop myself sliding into the abyss.
24 hours?
Cleaverly said, "At least it gives you an ending for your speech." The Prime Minister tapped his forefingers on the table. Eventually he said to Leggett, "You'd better come with me. We can amend the speech in the car."
"I can come, if you prefer," said Cleaverly.
"No, you'd better wait here in case there are further developments in Berlin." Wilson said, "It's nearly 15:15. You need to go. The session starts in 15 minutes. Chamberlain pushed himself up from the table. As Leggett followed him, he was conscious of a look of pure loathing from Cleverly. In the entrance hall, Chamberlain stood under the brass lantern while Wilson helped him on with his overcoat. A dozen members of the Number 10 staff had gathered to see him off. He looked around him. "Is Annie..."
"She's gone on ahead," said Wilson. "Don't worry, she'll be in the gallery."
He brushed a few specks from Chamberlain's collar and gave him his hat. "I'll be there too." He fished the PM's umbrella from the stand and pressed it into his hand.
"Remember, you are prevailing, inch by inch."
The Prime Minister nodded. The porter opened the door. The familiar, brilliant white glare briefly silhouetted him, and Leggett thought how slight a figure he looked, even in his overcoat, rather like a blackbird himself. He doffed his hat, first right, then left, and stepped onto the pavement. There were a few cheers, a little applause. A woman shouted, "God bless you, Mr. Chamberlain!" It sounded as though there was hardly anyone present. But when Leggett followed him out into the blinding light and his eyes adjusted, he saw that Downing Street was actually filled from end to end with a silent, shuffling multitude so huge that a policeman mounted on a horse had been brought in to escort the car. The Prime Minister climbed into the Austin through the near side door. His plainclothes detective got in beside the driver. Leggett had to squeeze his way around through the crowd to the other side. It was hard to open the door. He slid into the seat beside the Prime Minister. The crush of bodies closed the door after him. Through the windscreen, he could see the rear end of the police horse. It moved off slowly, clearing a path for them. The Prime Minister murmured,
"I have never seen anything like this in my life."
Flashbulbs lit the interior. It took them almost a minute to reach the top of Downing Street and turn right into Whitehall. A huge crowd stretched ahead, 8 or 10 deep on the pavements, and gathered around the cenotaph, which rose from a field of freshly laid flowers. A pair of Chelsea pensioners in their medals and scarlet uniforms, carrying a wreath of poppies between them, turned to stare at the Prime Minister's car as it drove past. Leggett pulled out his fountain pen and flicked through to the last page of the speech. It was hard to write in the moving car. "Signor Mussolini has informed Herr Hitler that while Italy will fulfil its obligations to Germany, it nevertheless requests that mobilisation be postponed for 24 hours. Herr Hitler has agreed." He showed it to the Prime Minister, who shook his head.
"No, that doesn't go far enough. I must pay some kind of tribute to Musso. We need to keep him on our side."
He closed his eyes.
"Write this down. Whatever views honourable members may have had about Signor Mussolini in the past, I believe that everyone will welcome his gesture of being willing to work with us for peace in Europe."
As they entered Parliament Square, the car was once again forced to slow to walking pace, then brought to a halt. Mounted police surrounded them. The grey sky, the sombre quiet of the crowd, the red wreaths, the clatter of the horses' hooves, it was like a state funeral, thought Leggett, or the 2-minute silence on Armistice Day. Finally, the car broke free and they accelerated through the iron gates into New Palace Yard. He glimpsed a policeman saluting. Their tyres thumped over the cobbles. They passed under an arch into Speaker's Court and pulled up beside a Gothic wooden door. The detective jumped out. A few seconds later, Chamberlain was across the cobbles and climbing the stone staircase, Leggett behind him. They emerged onto a green-carpeted, wood-panelled corridor directly adjacent to the Commons Chamber. 600 MPs were already assembled, waiting for the session to begin. Through the closed doors came a continuous low rumble of conversation. In the outer office of the Prime Minister's suite, the female secretary stood to attention as the PM entered. Chamberlain marched past them into the conference room, handing his hat and umbrella to Miss Watson. He shrugged off his overcoat. Two men were waiting by the long table. His parliamentary private secretary, Alec Dunglass, the heir to an earldom whose misfortune, or perhaps it was the key to his success, was to look as if he had just stepped out of a novel by P.G. Wodehouse, and the chief whip, Captain Margeson. The Prime Minister said, "I'm sorry to keep you all waiting. The crowds are quite unbelievable." Margeson said briskly, "If you're ready, Prime Minister, it's only 2:45. We should go in right away." "Very well." They walked back out of the office and across the corridor towards the doors of the chamber. The noise grew louder. The Prime Minister adjusted his cuffs. "What is the mood of the House?" "Strong support for your action right across the party. Even Winston is subdued. You'll see some contraption beside the dispatch box. You can ignore it. The BBC wanted to broadcast your statement, but the Labour whips have refused. They say it gives the government an unfair advantage." Dunglass said, "I've put a little brandy in your water, Prime Minister. It's good for the voice." "Thank you, Alec." Chamberlain stopped and held out his hand. Leggett gave him his copy of the speech. He weighed it in his hand and managed a smile. "I certainly have a lot to get through." Dunglass pulled the doors open. Margeson went in first. He used his shoulders to clear a path through the MPs, who were crowded around the Speaker's chair. As the Prime Minister came into the full view of the chamber, the rumble of noise swelled to a deep, masculine roar. Leggett felt it as something almost visceral. The heat, the colour, the noise, like emerging into a football stadium. He turned right and made his way with Miss Watson to the bench reserved for government officials. Behind him, the Speaker's voice cut through the din. "Order! Order! The House will come to order!" The Prime Minister was heard in absolute silence. No member rose to interrupt him as he recounted, day by day, sometimes hour by hour, the narrative of the crisis. The only movement came from the House messengers in their black frock coats and ceremonial chains, endlessly bringing in telegrams and pink telephone slips, recording the messages that were pouring into Westminster. "So I resolved to go to Germany myself to interview Herr Hitler and find out in personal conversation whether there was as yet any hope of saving the peace." From his vantage point, Leggett could see Winston Churchill leaning forward on the Conservative front bench below the gangway, listening intently, accumulating telegram after telegram, which he held bundled together with a red elastic band. In the gallery, the former Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, rested his arms on the wooden railing and gazed down at proceedings like a farmer at market wearing his Sunday best. Further along, the pale, powdered, imperial effigy of Queen Mary, the mother of the King, regarded Chamberlain without expression. Nearby sat Lord Halifax. "I knew very well that in taking such an unprecedented course, I was laying myself open to criticism on the ground that I was detracting from the dignity of a British Prime Minister, and to disappointment, and perhaps even resentment, if I failed to bring back a satisfactory agreement. But I felt that in such a crisis, where the issues at stake were so vital for millions of human beings, such considerations could not be allowed to count." Leggett checked the Prime Minister's delivery against his copy of the speech, marking the few occasions when Chamberlain departed from the text. The PM's manner was unhurried, forensic, quietly theatrical, now with his thumbs tucked behind the lapels of his jacket, now putting on a pair of pince-nez to read from a document, now removing them to gaze briefly up at the skylight as if seeking inspiration. He described his two visits to Hitler as if he were a Victorian explorer at the Royal Geographical Society, reporting on his expeditions to meet some savage warlord. "On 15 September, I made my first flight to Munich. There I travelled by train to Herr Hitler's mountain home at Berchtesgaden. On the 22nd, I went back to Germany, to Gütersberg on the Rhine, where the Chancellor had appointed a meeting place as being more convenient for me than the remote Berchtesgaden. Once again, I had a very warm welcome in the streets and villages through which I passed." The Prime Minister had been on his feet for more than an hour, and was just embarking on a description of the events of the last 2 days, as a last effort to preserve peace, I sent Sir Horace Wilson to Berlin, when Leggett became aware of a disturbance in the Peers' Gallery. Cadogan was standing at the entrance, accompanied by a messenger. He was waving his hand, trying to attract the attention of Lord Halifax. Eventually it was Baldwin who noticed him, and who reached round behind the back of Queen Mary and tapped the Foreign Secretary on the shoulder. He pointed to Cadogan, who beckoned urgently to Halifax to come and join him. Halifax rose stiffly, his useless arm dangling at his side, and, with much bowing and apology to Her Majesty, made his way to the back of the gallery and disappeared. Yesterday morning, Sir Horace Wilson resumed his conversations with Herr Hitler, and, finding his views apparently still unchanged, repeated to him in precise terms, on my instructions, that should the forces of France become actively involved in hostilities against Germany, the British government would feel obliged to support them. Leggett whispered to Miss Watson, "Would you mind just checking what the PM says against the text?" Without waiting for a reply, he handed her the speech. The tension in the chamber was rising sentence by sentence as the Prime Minister's narrative drew closer to the present. The MPs standing between the official's box were too rapt to take any notice of Leggett as he twisted and squeezed his way between them. "Excuse me. Sorry." He reached the area at the back of the Speaker's chair just as Cadogan and Halifax came through the door. Cadogan saw him and waved at him to come over. He said quietly, "We've just received a further message from Hitler. We need to inform the PM before he finishes speaking." He pressed a note into Leggett's hand. "Give this to Alec Dunglass." It was a single sheet of paper, folded once, with "Prime Minister, urgent," written on the outside. Leggett went back into the chamber. He could see Dunglass sitting on the second row of benches, immediately behind the Prime Minister's place. There was no way he could reach him directly. He gave the note to the MP at the end of the bench. He was aware of hundreds of MPs opposite and behind, watching him, fascinated by what was going on. He whispered, "Would you mind passing this along to Lord Dunglass?" He followed its progress as it travelled from hand to hand like a lit fuse until it reached Dunglass, who opened it with his usual slightly goofy expression and read it. Immediately he leaned forward to whisper in the ear of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who put his hand over his shoulder and took the note. The Prime Minister had just finished reading out his latest telegrams to Hitler and Mussolini. "In reply, I am told Signor Mussolini has asked Herr Hitler for extra time to re-examine the situation and endeavour to find a peaceful settlement. Herr Hitler has agreed to postpone mobilisation for 24 hours. For the first time since he started speaking, there was a murmur of approval. "Whatever views honourable members may have had about Signor Mussolini in the past, I believe that everyone will welcome his gesture of being willing to work with us for peace in Europe." More noises of agreement. The Prime Minister paused and suddenly looked to the bench beside him, where Sir John Simon was tugging at the bottom of his jacket. He frowned and bent down, took the note and read it. The two men held a whispered conversation. The chamber was silent, watching. Finally, the Prime Minister straightened and placed the note on the dispatch box. "That is not all. I have something further to say to the House yet. I have now been informed by Herr Hitler that he invites me to meet him at Munich tomorrow morning. He has also invited Signor Mussolini and Monsieur Daladier. Signor Mussolini has accepted, and I have no doubt Monsieur Daladier will also accept. I need not say what my answer will be." The silence lasted a split second longer. Then came a deafening eruption of relief. All around the chamber, MPs, Labour and Liberals too, rose to their feet, applauding and waving their order papers. Some Conservatives actually stood on their benches to cheer. Even Churchill eventually lumbered to his feet, although he looked as sulky as a toddler. On and on it went, minute after minute, as the Prime Minister glanced around, nodding, smiling. He tried to speak, but they would not let him. Eventually he managed to wave them back into their places. "We are all patriots, and there can be no honourable member of this House who did not feel his heart leap that the crisis has been once more postponed, to give us an opportunity to try what reason and goodwill and discussion will do to settle a problem which is already within sight of settlement. Mr. Speaker, I cannot say any more. I am sure that the House will be ready to release me now to go and see what I can make of this last effort. Perhaps they may think it will be well, in view of this new development, that this debate shall stand adjourned for a few days, when perhaps we may meet in happier circumstances." There was further prolonged acclamation, and it was only then, to his embarrassment, that Leggett realised he had forgotten his professional neutrality and had been cheering with all the rest. Chapter 4. On the principle that the best hiding place is in plain sight, the core group of conspirators met at 5 o'clock that afternoon in Kord's office in the Prussian State Building. Gisevius and von Schulenburg from the Interior Ministry, Dohanyi from Justice, Colonel Oster of the Abwehr, and Kord and Hartmann from the Foreign Service. 6 men. Hartmann found it hard to restrain his contempt. 6 men to bring down a dictatorship that controlled every aspect of life and society in a country that had swollen to 80 million. He felt naive and humiliated. The whole thing was a joke. Kort said, "I propose that if anyone asks us about this meeting, we should tell them it was purely informal, to discuss creating an interdepartmental planning group of the newly liberated Sudeten territories." Dohanyi nodded. "That has a certain horrible bureaucratic plausibility. Naturally, Beck cannot be seen anywhere near us, nor can Heinz, for that matter." "The newly liberated Sudeten territories," repeated Gisevius. "Listen to how that sounds. My God, he's going to be more popular than ever." Schulenburg said, "And why not? First Austria, now the Sudetenland. The Führer has added 10 million ethnic Germans to the Reich in less than 7 months without needing to fire a shot. Goebbels will say he's our greatest statesman since Bismarck. And perhaps he is." He looked around the room. "Have you considered that, gentlemen, that we may be wrong?" Nobody responded. Kord was seated behind his desk. Oster was leaning against it. Gisevius, Schulenburg, and Dohanyi occupied the 3 armchairs. Hartmann was sprawled full length on his back on the sofa, hands folded behind his head, staring at the ceiling. His large feet dangled over the armrest. Eventually he said quietly, "So what happened to the army, Colonel Oster?" Oster shifted his backside slightly against the desk. "In the end, everything depended on Brauchitsch. Unfortunately, he was still making up his mind what to do when the Führer issued the order to postpone mobilization for 24 hours. And if mobilization hadn't been postponed, would he have acted then? Beck says that Halder told him he was definitely sympathetic." Hartmann interrupted him. "Beck says Halder told him sympathetic." He swung his legs to the floor and sat up straight. "Forgive me, gentlemen, but if you ask me, this is just castles in the air. If Brauchitsch had been serious about getting rid of Hitler, he would have gone ahead and done it." "That's too simplistic. It was always understood that the only circumstances in which the army would take action would be if they were convinced there was going to be a war against France and Britain." "Because they thought that Germany would lose?" "Exactly. So let us be clear about the logic of the army's position. They have no moral objection to Hitler's regime. Their opposition is entirely conditional on the country's military prospects." "Yes, of course." "Is that so shocking? They're soldiers, not clergymen." "Well, that is very nice for them, I'm sure. No need for conscience there. But you see what it means for the rest of us." He looked at each of the others in turn. "As far as the army is concerned, as long as Hitler is winning, he is safe. Only when he starts to lose will they turn against him, by which time it will be too late." "Keep your voice down," warned Kord. "Hess's office is just along the corridor." Oster was visibly controlling his temper. "I am as disappointed as you are, Hartmann. More so, I would imagine. Please don't forget, it has taken me months to get the army even this far. All summer I've been sending messages to London, telling them that if only they would stand firm, they could leave the rest to us. Unfortunately, I hadn't reckoned on the cowardice of the British and the French." Kord said, "They will pay a terrible price for it in the long run, and so will we." There was a silence. It still seemed unbelievable to Hartmann that Hitler had swerved away from war at the last minute. He had watched it happen, history made at a distance of 5 meters. The red-faced, trembling Attolico had stammered out his message loudly enough for everyone nearby to hear, as if he were a herald in a play. "The Duce informs you that whatever you decide, Führer, fascist Italy stands behind you. But the Duce is of the opinion that it would be wise to accept the British proposal and begs you to refrain from mobilization." As Schmidt translated the Italian into German, Hitler's face had betrayed neither anger nor relief. His features were as immobile as a bronze bust.
Tell the Duce that I accept his proposal.
And with that he had returned to his office. From the corridor came a burst of raucous laughter. The party officials were celebrating. Hartmann had narrowly managed to avoid their embraces on the way in. One had a bottle of schnapps he was passing round.
"So what are we to do now?" asked Gisevius. "If we can't make a move without the army, and if Hartmann's analysis of their attitude is correct, then we are nothing but a group of powerless civilians, doomed to wait and watch until our country is defeated."
"It seems to me there's only one chance left to us," said Hartmann. "We need to try to prevent an agreement being signed tomorrow at Munich."
"That's highly unlikely," said Kort. "It's as good as signed already. Hitler is going to accept what the British and the French have already offered him, which is basically what he asked for in the first place. Therefore, the conference is a ritual. Chamberlain and Daladier will fly in and stand in front of the cameras and say, 'Here you are, dear Führer,' and then they'll fly home again."
"It doesn't have to be like that. Hitler has postponed mobilization. He hasn't cancelled it."
"Nevertheless, I can assure you that is how it will be."
Hartmann said quietly, "I need to meet with Chamberlain."
"Ha!" Cord threw up his hands. "Naturally!"
"I'm serious."
"Your seriousness is not the issue. In any case, we're past that stage. My brother sat in Halifax's office in the Foreign Office just 3 weeks ago and warned him explicitly what was coming. It still did no good."
Hartmann said, "Halifax isn't Chamberlain." Bohany said,
"But my dear Hartmann, what could you possibly say to him that would make the slightest difference?"
"I'd show him proof."
"Proof of what?"
"Proof that Hitler is bent on a war of conquest and that this may be the last chance to stop him." Bohany appealed to the others.
"This is simply foolish. As if Chamberlain would take any notice of a low-level young person such as Hartmann."
Hartmann shrugged. "Nevertheless, it's worth a try. Does anyone have an alternative idea?"
Schulenburg said, "Might we also be allowed to see this proof?"
"I would prefer not."
"Why?"
"Because I promised the person who gave it to me I would only show it to the British." There was some muttering of protest, scepticism, irritation.
"I must say I find it highly offensive that you won't trust us."
"Do you really, Schulenburg?"
"Well, I'm afraid that can't be helped."
Oster said, "And how do you propose to arrange your own private meeting with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom?" "Obviously, as a first step, I would need to be accredited to the conference as part of the German delegation."
Kort said,
"How is that to happen? And even if you were let in, there's simply no possibility you could get access to Chamberlain alone."
"I believe it could be done."
"Quite impossible. How?"
"I know one of his private secretaries." The revelation took them by surprise. After a pause, Oster said, "Well, that is something, I suppose.
Although I'm not sure how it helps us.
It means I must stand a chance of getting through to Chamberlain, or at least of getting my information into his hands." He leaned forward, imploring,
"Nothing may come of it, I accept. I understand your scepticism, but surely it is worth one last try.
Colonel Oster, you have contacts in Whitehall?"
"Yes."
"Is there time to get a message to them, to ask if this man could fly to Munich as part of Chamberlain's entourage?"
"Possibly. What's his name?"
Hartmann hesitated. Now it came to it, he found it oddly difficult to say it out loud. "Hugh Leggett." Oster produced a small notebook from his breast pocket and wrote it down.
"And he works in Downing Street, you say? Will he be expecting to hear from you?"
"Possibly. I've already sent him something anonymously, and I'm fairly sure he will guess it's from me. He knows I'm in the Foreign Ministry."
"How did you get it to him?"
Hartmann turned to Cord. "Your brother delivered it." Cord's mouth flapped open in surprise.
"You used Theo behind my back?"
"I wanted to open my own channel of communication, to show him something, to establish I was serious."
"And what was this earlier something? Or is that also secret?"
Hartmann was silent.
Schulenburg said bitterly, "No wonder the English don't take us seriously. We must appear to them to be complete amateurs, each man speaking for himself, no central coordination, no plan for a Germany without Hitler. I've had enough of this, gentlemen."
He pushed himself out of his armchair. Cord followed suit. He held out his hands in appeal. Schulenburg, please, sit down. We've suffered a reverse, we're disappointed, but let's not bicker among ourselves. Schulenburg grabbed his hat. He pointed it at Hartmann. You, with your stupid schemes, will get us all shot. He slammed the door behind him. As the reverberations died away, Dohanyi said, He's quite right. I agree, said Gisevius. Oster said, So do I. But we're at an impasse. And on balance, I'm inclined to support Hartmann's plan. Not that I think it will work, but because we have nothing to lose. What do you say, Erich? Cord had lowered himself back into his chair. He looked more like a man in his 50s than his mid-30s. He took off his spectacles, closed his eyes, and massaged his eyelids with his thumb and forefinger. The Munich conference, he muttered, is a locomotive that cannot be stopped. In my opinion, it's useless even to try. He put his glasses back on and stared at Hartmann. His eyes were pink with exhaustion. On the other hand, even if we can't derail it, it would obviously be valuable to our cause to open communication with someone who sees Chamberlain every day. Because of one thing, we may be sure, today isn't the end of this process. Given what we know of Hitler, the Sudetenland is only the start. There will be other crises, perhaps fresh opportunities. So let us see what you can do, Paul. But I think at the very least you should tell us what it is you plan to give to the British. You owe us that. No, I'm sorry. Perhaps when I return, if I can get agreement from my source, I'll show you them. But for now, for your own sakes as well as theirs, it's probably better if you don't know. Another silence ensued. Finally, Oster said, If we are to try to make this happen, we have no more time to lose. I'll go back to Teopitzufel and try to make contact with the British. Erich, is it possible for you to get Hartmann into the conference? I'm not sure. I can try. Couldn't you speak to Ribbentrop? God, no, he's the last man I'd approach. He would be suspicious at once. Our best hope is probably Weizsäcker. He likes to play both ends. I'll go and talk to him. He turned to Hartmann. You'd better come too. Oster said, We should probably leave separately. No, said Kort. Remember, we've merely held an informal interdepartmental meeting. It will look more natural if we all go out together. At the door, Oster drew Hartmann to one side. He said in a low voice so that the others couldn't hear, You have a weapon, I believe. I should return it to the Abwehr Armory. Hartmann held his gaze. I think I would prefer to keep it, if you don't mind. Hartmann and Kort left the building together and walked in silence across Wilhelmstrasse towards the Foreign Ministry. The sun was shining. A definite lightness was in the air. One could see it on the faces of the government workers pouring out of the ministries to go home at the end of the day. People were even laughing. It was the first time Hartmann had seen such normality in the streets since the Czech crisis blew up more than 2 weeks ago. In the State Secretary's outer office, all three typists, including Frau Winter, were bent over their machines. Kord had to raise his voice to be heard above the racket. We need to see Baron von Weizsäcker. Frau Winter looked up. He's with the British and French ambassadors. Kord said, Even so, Frau Winter, it's an urgent matter. She glanced at Hartmann. Her expression was one of complete indifference. He admired her coolness. He had a sudden vision of her naked on the bed waiting for him, her long white limbs, her heavy breasts, her nipples hard. Very well. She tapped lightly on the door to the inner office and went inside. Hartmann heard a clink of glasses, voices, and laughter. Less than a minute later, Sir Neville Henderson emerged, a scarlet carnation fresh in his lapel, followed by François Poncet. The French ambassador had a small black moustache, waxed upwards at the tips. He looked rakish, amused, like an actor from the Comédie Française. He was said to be the only member of the diplomatic corps whom Hitler actually liked. The ambassadors nodded amiably at Hartmann, then shook hands with Kort. François Poncet said, This is a relief, Kort. He continued to pump Kord's hand.
A great relief. I was with the Führer moments before he spoke to Attalico.
When he returned to the room, his exact words to me were, "Tell your government I have postponed mobilization for 24 hours to meet the wishes of my great Italian ally." Imagine if the communists had cut the telephone lines from Rome to Berlin that morning. We would all be at war. Instead of which, he flourished his hand at the room, we still have a chance.
Kord bowed slightly. Your Excellency, it is a great deliverance.
Frau Winter appeared at the door.
The State Secretary is waiting for you.
Hartmann caught her scent as he passed her.
Henderson called after them, We shall see you in Munich. We haven't finished this thing yet.
Von Weizsäcker had a bottle of Sekt open on his desk. He did not bother with a Hitler salute.
Gentlemen, let us empty the bottle.
He poured out 3 glasses expertly, so that not a drop was lost, and handed one each to Kord and Hartmann. He raised his glass.
As I said to the ambassadors, I won't propose a toast. I don't want to tempt fate.
Let us simply enjoy the moment. Hartmann sipped politely. The sparkling wine was too sweet and fizzy for his taste, like a child's drink.
Sit, please.
Weizsäcker gestured to a sofa and 2 armchairs. His dark blue pinstripe suit was beautifully cut. The swastika lapel bin glinted in the late afternoon sunlight slanting through the high window. He had only joined the party that year. Now he had an honorary rank in the SS and was Germany's senior diplomat. If he had sold his soul, he had at least got a good price.
What can I do for you, gentlemen?
Kold said,
I would like to propose that Hartmann here is accredited to our delegation at the conference tomorrow.
Are you asking me?
Ask the minister. You're a member of his office.
With the greatest respect to the minister, his automatic response to any suggestion is generally to say no, until he can be won round, and in this instance there is no time for the usual process of persuasion.
And why is it so important that Hartmann goes to Munich?
Apart from the fact that his English is impeccable, which will be useful in itself, we believe there is an opportunity for him to cultivate a potentially important contact on Chamberlain's staff.
Really?
Weizsäcker studied Hartmann with interest.
Who is this person?
Hartmann said, He is a diplomat, presently working as one of Chamberlain's private secretaries.
How do you know him?
I was at Oxford with him.
Is he sympathetic to the new Germany?
I doubt it.
Hostile, then?
I should imagine he shares the general attitude of Englishmen of his type.
That could mean anything.
Weizsäcker turned back to Kord. How do you know he will even be in Munich?
We don't.
Colonel Oster of the Abwehr is trying to arrange it.
Ah, Colonel Oster.
Weizsäcker nodded slowly.
Now I understand. That sort of contact.
He poured himself the last of the sect and drank it slowly. Hartmann contemplated his bobbing Adam's apple, the smooth pink cheeks, the fine silver hair that matched his brand new party badge. He felt the contempt rise in his throat like gorge. He would take an old brown shirt with a broken nose any day over this hypocrite. The State Secretary replaced his empty glass on the table.
You want to be careful of Colonel Oster. You might even warn him from me. His activities have not gone entirely unnoticed. Up to now there has been a certain toleration of dissent, so long as it doesn't go too far. But I sense things are starting to change. National Socialism is moving into a new and more vigorous phase.
He went over to his desk, felt around under it, and pressed a button. The door opened.
Frau Winter, would you add Herr von Hartmann's name to the list of those accredited to the conference tomorrow? Put him down as a translator to assist Dr. Schmidt.
Yes, sir.
She withdrew. Kord caught Hartmann's eye and nodded. Both men stood.
Thank you, State Secretary.
Yes, said Hartmann. Thank you. He hesitated. May I ask a question, Herr Baron?
What is it?
I was wondering what caused the Führer to change his mind. Did he really intend to invade, do you think, or was he bluffing all along?
Oh, he wanted to invade, no question of it.
So why did he call it off?
Who can say? No one really knows what's in his mind.
I suspect in the end he realized Chamberlain had removed his casus belli. Mussolini's intervention was decisive in that regard. Goebbels put it rather well over lunch, even though he personally favoured invasion. One can't wage a world war over points of detail. The Führer's error was to list specific demands. Once they had mostly been met, he was stranded. I suspect he won't make the same mistake next time.
Frau Winter said, "Your name will be on the list at the Anhalter Bahnhof, Herr Hartmann. It will be enough if you show your identification at the gate. The special train is scheduled to leave at 8:50 tonight."
"The train?"
"Yes, the Führer's train." He was conscious of Cord waiting for him, of the two other women typing. Cord touched his arm. "We'd better hurry. You need to pack." They went out into the corridor. Hartmann glanced back over his shoulder, but she was already seated at her desk, typing. Something about her complete indifference disturbed him. As they walked, he said, "That was easier than I'd expected. Yes, our new state secretary is so delightfully ambiguous, isn't he? He manages to be both a pillar of the regime and to indicate his sympathy for the opposition at the same time. Are you going straight to your apartment?" "Not immediately. I need to pick up something from my office first." "Oh, of course." Cord shook his hand. "I'll leave you then. Good luck." His office was deserted. No doubt von Nostitz and von Rantzau were out celebrating somewhere. He sat at his desk and unlocked the drawer. The envelope was where he had left it. He slipped it into his briefcase. Hartmann's apartment was at the western end of Pariserstrasse, in the fashionable shopping district close to St. Ludwig's Church. Before the war, when his grandfather, the old ambassador, had still been alive, the family had owned the whole building, but they had been obliged to split it up and sell it piece by piece to repay the mortgage on the estate near Rostock. Now there was only the second floor left. He stood at the window with a tumbler of whiskey, smoking a cigarette, and watched the last traces of the sun disappear behind the trees of Ludwigkirchplatz. The sky glowed red. The trees looked like the shadows of primitive dancers cavorting around a fire. On the radio, the opening of Beethoven's Coriolan overture signalled the start of a special news bulletin. The announcer sounded half-crazed with excitement. "Prompted by the desire to make a last effort to bring about the peaceful secession of the Sudeten German territory to the Reich, the Führer has invited Benito Mussolini, the head of the Italian government, Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and Édouard Daladier, the French Prime Minister, to a conference. The statesmen have accepted the invitation. The discussion will take place in Munich tomorrow morning, September 29th. The communique made it seem as if the whole thing had been Hitler's idea. And people would believe it, thought Hartmann, because people believed what they wanted to believe. That was Goebbels' great insight. They no longer had any need to bother themselves with inconvenient truths. He had given them an excuse not to think. He drank more whiskey. He was still troubled by his encounter in Weizsäcker's office. The whole thing had been too easy. There had also been something odd about her absolutely determined refusal to meet his eye. He replayed the scene over and over. Perhaps she had not stolen the documents from von Weizsäcker's safe after all. Perhaps she had merely been given them to pass on to him. The moment he thought of it, he knew it must be true. He stubbed out his cigarette and went into the bedroom. On top of the wardrobe was a small suitcase embossed with his initials, which he had been given when he was first sent away to school. He flicked open the catches. Inside were letters, mostly, from his parents and his brothers and sisters, from friends and girlfriends. The Oxford letters were tied together and still in their envelopes. He had liked the English stamps, and to see his name and address written in Hugh's small, neat hand. At one period, he had written to him once or twice a week. There were photographs, too, including the last photograph of them together, taken in Munich, the date written on the back, 2nd July 1932. They were in walking gear, boots, sports jackets, open-necked white shirts, a glimpse of a courtyard in the background. Lena stood between them, her hands gripping their upper arms. She was so much shorter than he was, it was comical. All three smiling.
He remembered she had asked the owner of the inn to take it before they set out for the day. Clipped to it was the cutting from the Daily Express he had come across in the summer. Among the Foreign Office's brightest young stars, now assisting the PM, judging by the photograph, he had hardly changed. But the fashionable woman beside him, his wife, this Pamela, she was not at all the sort of girl he had imagined that Hugh would end up with. It occurred to him that if something went wrong and his apartment was searched by the Gestapo, these souvenirs would be incriminating. He took the Oxford letters over to the fireplace and burned them, one by one, setting fire to the bottom right-hand corner of each with his lighter and dropping it into the grate. He burned the newspaper cutting. He hesitated over the photograph, but finally he burnt that too, watching it scorch and curl until it was indistinguishable from the other ashes. It was dark by the time Hartmann arrived at the Anhalter Bahnhof. Outside the pillared entrance to the main concourse, police were patrolling with dogs. In his suitcase, he had the envelope. In his inside pocket, the Walter. He felt his legs begin to weaken. He braced his shoulders and passed through the grand doors into the smoke and gloom of the glass-roofed station as high as a Gothic cathedral. Swastika banners, three or four stories high, descended over every platform. The annunciator board displayed the evening's departures. Leipzig, Frankfurt am Main, Dresden, Vienna. It was 8:37 p.m. There was no mention of Munich or a special train. An official of the Reichsbahn, in dark blue uniform and peaked cap, his toothbrush moustache doubtless grown in homage to the Führer, noticed his uncertainty. When Hartmann explained his mission, he insisted on escorting him personally. "It will be my honour." Hartmann spotted the gate before they reached it. Somehow people must have guessed that the Führer would be passing through, and a small, respectful crowd of about 100 had gathered, women mostly. The SS were keeping them at a distance. At the gate itself, two more police dog handlers and SS guards with machine guns were checking passengers. A man who was queuing to board was being ordered to open his suitcase, and Hartmann thought, "If they frisk me, I'm finished." He thought of turning back and dumping the gun in the toilets, but the Reichsbahn official was ushering him forward, and a moment later he found himself face to face with one of the sentries.
"Heil Hitler!"
"Heil Hitler."
"Name?"
"Hartmann." The sentry ran his finger down the list of names, flipped one page, then another.
"There's no Hartmann here."
"There." Hartmann pointed to the last page. Unlike the others, which were typed, his name had been added in ink.
"Papers?"
He handed over his identity card. The other sentry said,
"Open your suitcase, please."
He balanced it on his knee. His hands were shaking. He was sure his guilt must be obvious. He fumbled with the catches, lifted the lid. The sentry shouldered his machine gun and rummaged through the contents. Two shirts, underwear, shaving kit and a leather case. He picked up the envelope, shook it and put it back. He nodded. With his gun barrel, he gestured towards the train. The first sentry returned his ID.
"You are in the rear carriage, Herr von Hartmann."
They started to check the man behind. Hartmann walked through, onto the platform. The train was drawn up about 20 meters along the track, on the right-hand side. It was long. He counted 7 carriages, all a gleaming, spotless dark green, as if freshly painted for the occasion, with a Nazi eagle, wings spread wide, picked out on the bodywork in gold. Every door was guarded by an SS sentry. At the front, a black locomotive gently vented steam. It, too, was guarded. Hartmann walked slowly towards the rear carriage, took a last look up at the floodlit spars of the roof, the fluttering pigeons, the black sky beyond, then clambered aboard. It was a sleeper car, the compartments on the left. An SS adjutant, a clipboard in one hand, marched along the corridor, halted and thrust out his arm in the Hitler salute. Hartmann recognized him as the same white-jacketed flunky he had threatened that morning at the Chancellery. He returned the salute with what he hoped was a convincing snap of fanaticism.
"Good evening, Herr von Hartmann. Follow me, please."
They walked to the end of the carriage. The adjutant checked his clipboard and slid open the door of the final compartment.
"This is your berth. Refreshments will be served in the dining car once we have left Berlin.
You will then be informed of the operations of the Führer train. He saluted again. Hartmann stepped into the compartment and closed the door behind him. It was done out in the Art Deco style favoured by the Führer. Two bunks, upper and lower, dimmish yellow lighting, a smell of wood.